41, 3.5 minutes left to go in the fourth. Huskies lose the ball out of bounds. Three will come in for 40 for the Huskies. Chase will take the ball down. Passing to Riley. Chase running high post. Riley up for three. No good. Logan gets the rebound, passing off to Chase. Up for three. No good. Brennan back up for two. No good. Robert gets the rebound, back up for two, and it's good. Huskies will take the ball down. Finding number 22 up for three. No good. Chase will get the rebound. Gonna lob it to Riley up for two, and it's good. Two and a half minutes left to go in the fourth. T-Jack 70, Huskies 41. That will be a jump ball. And it will go to the T-Jack. Jersey Sailor and James will come in for Logan, Riley, and Robert. Putting their bench in except for Chase and Brennan. James in the corner. Chase tries passing it to James, but James will cut it. Thirty will take the ball down for the Huskies. Passing it to 22. Finds two in the corner for three. No good. Taylor will get the rebound. Gonna pass it off to Brennan. Finds James. Up for three. No good. Taylor gets the rebound. Puts it back up for two. And it's good. Number two's gonna take the drive. No good. 30 gets the rebound. No good. 32 will get the rebound. Passing off a three, then a two up top. Finds 30 down low. Chase gets the steal out of bounds. Loses the ball off of his foot. Is going to have it up top. Putting it up to two. Saves it. Brennan. Gonna get the fast break, decides not to take it, slows it down, passes it to the other team. T-Jacks aren't even gonna try. Chase is gonna chase him down. Then he gets the rebound. Jersey, and then Sailor. Jersey, wide open for three, takes it, no good. Then, back up for two, no good. That'll be a foul on the ground on the Huskies. Brennan's going to pass it in Jersey. Has to steal the ball. Getting the fast break. James only T-Jack down there. Up for two, and it's good. Sarah's going to pass it in to James. 30 seconds left. Going to pass it to Brennan. James up for three. No good. Sarah gets the rebound. Back up for two. No good. Fast break up for two, no good, and a foul. I think his glasses broke. Oh. 14 seconds left of the fourth. T-Jacks at 72. Huskies at 43. If he makes it, it'll be 44. Second shot is good. Huskies 44, T-Jack 72. Chase gonna take the ball down. Pass out to James, up for three. Short. Saylor, down low, put back up, no good. 22, up for three. That'll be the end of the T-Jacks Huskies game. Huskies at 47, T-Jacks 72. Broadcast and commentary brought to you by KSDP. The next game will be at 9 a.m. for the rookies and Tribe Valley.
All right, thank you, Rivera. You heard it. 72-47 in favor of the King Cove T-Jacks. And like she said, our next game will be 9 a.m. That will be the King Cove Rookies against the Tri-Valley Warriors. We'll be there to give you some more games then. Until then, we'll get you back to your regular programming.
We'll be right back. KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Anchorage, Alaska area has its first small-scale casino. The Aklutna tribe began operations on Monday night in a building in Birchwood. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, it was constructed in less than a week.
The whirlwind effort to get the tribe's gaming hall up and running is in sharp contrast to the decades it spent fighting for the legal right to operate it. So why the hurry? Did the timing have anything to do with a new president? While Trump celebrated his inauguration, you could hear the steady roar of machinery at the tribe's casino. Construction equipment raced around a five-piece modular building, bolted together and propped up on wooden blocks. Even so, the Chenan Gaming Hall opened early that evening, and Dan Amadon was the very first to feed money into a gaming machine.
You put a little in, you get a little back. That's the fun of it.
Amadon operates a shop next door. And although this patch of land outside Anchorage still seems more like a construction zone, Aaron Leggett, president of the Native Village of Aklutna, called the first day of operations a historic milestone for the tribe. The building sits on a Native allotment that a year ago did not have the necessary Indian country status for gambling. But last year, the U.S. Interior Department changed its Alaska policies, and the tribe got final approval from Brian Newland, the outgoing Assistant Secretary of Interior, just 5 days before the Trump administration takeover. Don Mitchell, the lawyer for property owners who have sued the tribe, believes the scramble to open was to head off the governor of Alaska's request to Trump to block the casino.
And they somehow think that by opening up a symbolic casino, that will improve their legal position.
The tribe says it's not so much fear of Trump, but fear of more delays caused by turnover in administrations. It says once it's in full operation, its small-scale casino will be an economic lifeline for its members. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Tribal leaders in the Southwest are addressing concerns from their tribal members as the Trump administration rolls out the president's immigration orders, which include deportation plans. The Navajo Nation, located in the Four Corners region, and the Mescalero Apache tribe in New Mexico say they've received concerns this week about circulating stories of tribal members being approached by U.S. immigration and custom enforcement agents in urban areas. The Navajo Nation Council on Thursday urged Navajo Nation President Boone Igren to take immediate actions on what it said are raids in Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. The council says it's sparking fear. Nigren says as of Thursday night, there were no confirmed cases of detentions of Navajo citizens, but he's asking Navajo people to stay informed, remain calm, and to carry a state-issued identification card. In a letter Thursday to Mescalero Apache members, the tribe stated it verified one incident where an ICE agent questioned a tribal member in a neighboring town. Mescalero Apache President Thora Walsh Padilla addressed concerns in a social media video message to tribal members, asking them to report any encounters.
We're very, very worried about our tribal members at this time, that such things like this could happen in this day and age, and we are doing everything we can. I mean, remember that we are the indigenous people of this area, and we are also a sovereign nation, and we do have rights.
The tribe's working with New Mexico's congressional delegation and has posted information on its website for tribal members about how to respond if confronted by U.S. immigration agents. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
DT Track, your healthcare partner, provides access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. More at dt-track.com who support this show. Skugdash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Ye.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
This is an effort to keep our residents here, who their number one thing is, how are you going to educate my kids?
Lawmakers introduced a bill that would increase state funding to public schools by nearly $500 million. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 24th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, school closures across the state have officials asking how schools can keep their students and their funding.
Change needs to happen because we see empty space in schools. We see not the best use. We see that we want improvement in student outcomes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
GCI, providing telecommunication services to tribal health organizations and nonprofit rural health providers, enabling telehealth services for Alaskans. More at gci.com/healthcare.
IBEW's path to success includes excellent training, good wages, benefits, and a comfortable retirement. Join the IBEW and build a bright future. Call 907-575-7285 to find out more. This message sponsored by IBEW Local 1547.
The Alaska Legislature is getting to work on a bill that would boost state funding for public schools by more than $460 million. Sitka Independent Representative Rebecca Himshut introduced the bill today that would boost basic per-student funding by roughly 30% over 3 years and adjust it for inflation. Himshut is a former teacher who co-chairs the House Education Committee, and she says the bill is an effort to catch up after years of inflation outpacing public school funding. She says prices have risen by 36% since 2011, and education funding has risen by less than 10% over that same period.
So there's a huge gap there, and I think that all of us have noticed and have heard from parents, from families, from school districts that that gap is there, and it's causing huge, huge problems and taking opportunity away from our students. So this bill looks to correct that.
Increasing the base student allocation is a key priority for leaders of both the House and the Senate. Education funding reached record levels last year after lawmakers passed a $175 million one-time funding increase for public schools. But it was just a one-year bump. It was not included in Governor Mike Dunleavy's budget for the next fiscal year. That means lawmakers will have to budget at least that much to keep school funding at current levels. Himshut's bill is just 2 pages and addresses only the base student allocation. That's a contrast with last year's approach when lawmakers pursued an omnibus funding bill that was ultimately vetoed by Dunleavy. The legislature failed by 1 vote to override his veto. Republican House Minority Leader Mia Costello of Anchorage says discussions on school funding are important, but equally important are new education policies that improve student performance. She says Republican lawmakers plan to discuss the funding issue at a retreat over the weekend. Senator Lukey Tobin, an Anchorage Democrat who chairs the Senate Education Committee, says she plans to introduce a similar bill in the upper chamber. And she says she thinks it's important to tackle the funding question before moving on to education policy issues.
All of those things I anticipate we will tackle in the next two years. However, you can't rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic as it goes down. You have to get the ship stabilized and moving in the right direction.
Majority lawmakers say they hope to move the bill through the House and Senate quickly, since school districts typically have to submit their budgets in early spring. Juneau Democratic Representative Andy Story, a former school board member who also co-chairs the House Education Committee, says the 3-year phase-in and inflation adjustment are meant to make budgeting more predictable and stem the tide of out-migration.
This is an effort to keep our residents here, who their number one thing is, how are you going to educate my kids?
Though it could ease budgeting for school districts, Republican Representative Will Stapp of Fairbanks says tying education funding to inflation might make the state's budget less predictable.
you know, inflation's tricky because we at a state level don't control monetary policy. So that's typically how a liability gets away from you in a budget process, is to tie it to something you don't control.
The House Education Committee plans to hear House Bill 69 at least three times next week. They'll take public testimony at two hearings scheduled for Wednesday. At least three school districts across the state are considering closing at least one school. The closures are one of the most visible signs of the state's shrinking population. And as Alaska Public Media's Tim Rocky reports, when a school shuts down, the impacts extend beyond the classroom.
School districts in Anchorage and Kodiak have already decided to close at least one school later this year. And the Fairbanks North Star Borough School Board will vote next month on whether to close five elementary schools. Anchorage and Fairbanks have framed their closure discussions as right-sizing, arguing that fewer school buildings are needed to serve a declining number of students. Nowhere has seen a more acute decrease in students than Fairbanks. Alaska has 3,600 fewer students than it did 25 years ago, and the Fairbanks School District accounts for two-thirds of that loss. Brandy Hardy is a Fairbanks School Board member. Born and raised in Fairbanks, a school she attended as a child has already been closed by the district. She voted to close Ben Eielson Junior Senior High School last year and will vote next month on whether to close several more.
Looking at the state of what's going on, it's why I joined the board, because when you see a problem, you try to fix it. That's what I wanted to do, and I have tried my damnedest to fix the problem, but the problem isn't at our school board. It's in Juneau with funding and with the way we've written our legislation. That's beyond our control. Unless that fixes and our schools improve, we're just going to see more and more people leaving the state.
District officials say inflation and roughly a decade of flat state funding have contributed to massive budget deficits, along with continued outmigration of residents from the state. Districts in Ketchikan, Sitka, and the Matanuska-Susitna Borough have also warned residents of looming budget shortfalls that may result in school closures or consolidation of programs. Hardy argues that state funding has fallen behind what Alaska schools need to stay afloat, while admitting that the school district needs to consolidate. She worries about the future for students at Hunter Elementary in Fairbanks, where she taught previously. She'll vote on a proposal to close the school next month.
We're supposed to take care of each other in our communities. And I am worried that if that safety net that we've built that is Hunter, that's been in our community for decades, is closed, what's going to happen to those kids?
Another significant change in student population has been the outmigration from neighborhood schools to charter and correspondence schools, which impacts the funding each district receives for those students. Over the last 25 years, 10,000 Alaska students have moved from neighborhood public schools to correspondence programs. And during that same time, 32 schools have been closed across the state. Alaska Education Commissioner Dina Bishop notes the issue of school closures is complex, but says public schools need to adapt to a changing environment in order to attract students.
I think we can all agree that change needs to happen because we see empty space in schools. We see not the best use. We see that we want improvement in student outcomes and opportunities. We don't want to lose our music programs. We don't want to lose this. So in order for Alaska to adjust to the changes that have naturally happened, like other industries have changed.
Bishop says an increase in state funding alone would not solve the financial issues districts are facing.
The pressure in the last 10 years of closing schools hasn't been because kids left the state of Alaska. What they're doing is choosing a different school type, and then that offers them more flexibility. So then how do we then support that and utilize schools too at the same time for other things?
Kevin Berry is an economics professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage and the parent of an Anchorage student who will have new classmates next fall due to school closures. Berry says despite the emotional process of closing a neighborhood school, Students and the surrounding community can benefit from consolidations.
These consolidations don't necessarily mean there'll be larger class sizes and worse outcomes, because they're not only being driven by insufficient funding, they're also being driven by demographic changes in the state.
Barry says the impacts of school closures reach beyond the classroom, but they're more damaging in rural communities and less noticeable in urban areas like Anchorage and Fairbanks. He also notes that inflation and outmigration are factors outside of school district control.
Yes, there is less funding because the BSA didn't keep up with inflation. That being said, the case for consolidation based on the number of students we're serving is in some ways a related but separate issue.
Leaders of the Alaska House and Senate say they plan to pass an education funding boost early in the legislative session. In Anchorage, I'm Tim Rocky.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a film shot and based in Ketchikan will appear at a film festival later this year.
One of the reasons I made this film is I think Ketchikan is one of the most beautiful places on earth, and I think the film is a testament to the artistic community in Ketchikan.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Alaska State Troopers fatally shot a man who shot and wounded a trooper in Kasilof after a four-hour standoff starting late last night and ending early this morning. The injured trooper was treated at a Kenai Peninsula hospital for non-life-threatening injuries. In a Friday dispatch, Alaska's Department of Public Safety said troopers responded to a 911 report around 10:20 p.m. Thursday. The caller reported a man yelling and shooting a gun near Crooked Creek Road. Troopers said when they located the man, 32-year-old Mason Toloff, he threatened to shoot them. In response, troopers activated their Southern SWAT team, who took control of the scene. Trooper spokesman Austin McDaniel says SWAT deployment was routine in this case.
The troopers created a perimeter, and at that point, the Alaska State Trooper SWAT team was activated, which would be a pretty standard procedure for somebody that has been discharging a weapon and threatens to shoot officers and is not following their commands.
Troopers say they deployed a drone to survey the area, which Toloff shot at multiple times. After that, he shot a state trooper in the leg. Less than an hour later, troopers say, Toloff pointed a shotgun at the law enforcement officers. Troopers say multiple SWAT officers then shot Toloff, who was declared dead at the scene. Troopers say the incident is being investigated by the Alaska Bureau of Investigation. Once that investigation is finished, it will be reviewed by the state's Office of Special Prosecutions. McDaniel said the injured trooper has since been released from the hospital and is recovering at home.
We're, again, very, very grateful that and thankful that this trooper only sustained non-life-threatening injuries because that's not usually the case when a law enforcement officer is shot.
McDaniel says it's, quote, incredibly rare for a trooper to be shot while on duty. He says the incident highlights the risks law enforcement face on the job.
The trooper's family and colleagues also really appreciate the outpouring of support that they've heard from community members, from government officials, in support of this trooper, as well as all the law enforcement officers that responded to a pretty dynamic incident last night in Kasilof.
All officers who fired weapons during the shooting have been put on 3 days' worth of administrative leave per department policy. The department will release their names in 3 days. Juno is set to house the Coast Guard's IVIC icebreaker soon. The ship is the nation's latest military vessel, despite a history of design problems and failure. ProPublica reporter Mackenzie Funk has covered icebreakers for almost two decades and detailed the history of the IVIC in his latest story. He says despite its flaws, the Coast Guard doesn't have a lot of alternatives as icebreakers become more necessary to the nation.
There is an increase in both traffic and interest in the high north, the possibility that there will be more commercial shipping, whether to and from natural resources, or maybe someday across through the Northwest Passage. That's been on the horizon as the reality of climate change has been seen by more people. And so the idea is both the need is growing because of growing shipping, but also the existing fleet is small and old, and so it needs to be replaced.
So now the Coast Guard has a icebreaker called the IVIC, but you note that the IVIC has had a history of troubles starting from its very first trip to Alaska. Can you walk me through what happened there?
The IVIC, it's just been renamed the Storis to as it rejoins the service with the Coast Guard, but it was originally built for Shell Oil. As everyone may remember, Shell made a major play for oil in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas, paid billions and billions of dollars. And one of a number of reasons that they eventually pulled back from that was what happened with the IVIC and the drill rig it was towing called the Kulik. And they went up in the summer of 2012 and had a cascading series of issues all throughout the summer. Shell, both ships that were connected to the IVIC and Kulik and other ships in the fleet, kept running into trouble. There were breakdowns, there were fires. And the IVIC itself, purpose-built, new, had a number of engine breakdowns. Not surprisingly, in the Gulf of Alaska, they hit a very large series of storms. A couple years later, Shell, having not found oil in the Chukchi and Beaufort, decided to pull out of Alaska, or pull out of the Arctic Ocean. And then this fancy ship was sitting there with nothing much to do.
So if there were all of these challenges, why did the Coast Guard buy the IVIC?
The funny thing is that Coast Guard had been asked to investigate this ship, and now they did investigate it, and they found design problems with it. And then a couple years later, they are being pressured to buy this ship. And there are two ways to look at this decision. One is the vast amount of pressure from members of Congress who had taken a vast amount of money from Edison Schwest, the ship owner and builder. Since 2012, Schwest has donated about $7 million to candidates and PACs and super PACs and state and national parties. So they're a major political donor. That's certainly part of the equation. And some of the members of Congress who were pushing most loudly, vociferously for the IVIC were people who had taken money from Schwest. But it's not the entirety of the story. The other part is what we talked about before, which is that the Coast Guard had still yet to build any of the new icebreakers they needed. And so that fleet that was already old when I started reporting on the Arctic has only become older.
I imagine some of those members of Congress were Alaska members of Congress.
Yes. Congressman Don Young was, I'd say, among the first, and certainly the loudest in pushing for the IVIC. He and the Schwest family have a long relationship. His lifetime total donations from the Schwest family was more than $300,000. Dan Sullivan also pushed for the IVIC after Congressman Young's death. Senator Murkowski has certainly been an advocate of adding to the icebreaker fleet. And important to note that they are also very publicly in favor of building new heavy icebreakers, which the Coast Guard says we need. No one is saying that the IVIC is the solution forever. It's more like we've kept on not solving the big problem we have. So let's do this as a stopgap.
So where do things stand for the IVIC now? Where's it going to be based and what's it going to be doing?
The IVIC, you know, some of its design limitations and mean that it can't do all the 11 missions that the Coast Guard would have, not all of which it does in the Arctic, but it's also not going to be able to do what some of the heavy icebreakers we hope to build will do, which is go through multi-year ice, go through ice thicker than about, say, 4.5 feet. I don't think we could see the IVIC going all the way to the North Pole, maybe not on its own, at least not with someone helping. But I think the idea is, for the moment, with minimal refitting, to put it up in service. It'll be based out of Juneau. That was one thing that Senator Sullivan pushed for in particular. And so I think we can imagine it'll be just up there patrolling around. And there is some value to that. It's not the full ship that the Coast Guard wants or the country needs, but the hope is that it'll be good enough for now.
Mackenzie Funk is a reporter with ProPublica.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska Pacific University empowers students to make a positive difference in their communities through programs in education, business, outdoor studies, public health, and more. Scholarship and other financial aid opportunities are available. Learn more and apply now at alaskapacific.edu to automatically be considered for most scholarships. Advance your career and your community with APU today. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
University of Alaska Anchorage Chancellor Sean Parnell has announced that he will retire at the end of the spring semester. In a message to the UAA community, Parnell said the university was well-suited for the future and, quote, it has been an honor to serve at UAA, where we create opportunities for others through our collective work. Parnell, who is 62, said he was retiring to spend more time with his family. Parnell was appointed as UAA Chancellor in 2021 by UA President Pat Pitney. Before that, he had a long political career, serving as governor from 2009 to 2014, after stints as lieutenant governor and as a state legislator. In a statement, Pitney described Parnell as an incredible leader and touted his experience in growing enrollment and building relationships with community partners. She says the university will navigate finding Parnell's replacement in the coming months. Meanwhile, an avalanche closed the Parks Highway near Cantwell this morning, dumping about 6 feet of snow and debris across mile 219. The incident happened around 10 a.m. Nobody was hurt, but the section of highway was blocked from both sides for most of the day. State Department of Transportation spokesperson Danielle Tessin says crews should be able to clear the area by tonight, but drivers should avoid the area until their work is done.
So if you're out there, if you see the additional equipment out there, give them extra space. They're working really hard over this warmer weekend before we're going to see colder weather come in on Monday.
Jason Laney is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Fairbanks. He says an atmospheric river is bringing a variety of severe weather conditions to the region. Laney says the avalanche risk in the interior will decrease as strong winds die down, but drivers should remain aware of icy conditions.
Folks that find themselves on the west side, that's where the heaviest of snow will fall. And folks to the east will be in the warm air, but still getting the same precipitation rates. That's resulting in very icy travel as well. So while the challenges and the impacts may be different, they're basically extreme throughout much of the central interior of Alaska today.
As of about 3:30 p.m. this afternoon, Alaska Department of Transportation crews were still clearing off the Parks Highway. A winter storm warning is projected to remain in effect for most of the interior until Monday afternoon. A crowdfunded sci-fi feature film set in Ketchikan and starring Ketchikan residents was just selected for its first film festival. The Ladder by Emilio Torres will be making its festival circuit premiere at the Fargo Film Festival this spring. KRBD's Jack Darrell has the story.
Ketchikan down there?
Yes, it is.
According to Emilio Torres, the last movie filmed in Ketchikan was the 1950s noir film Cry Vengeance. That is, until he completed his first feature-length film, The Ladder, last year. Torres is an NYU film school grad, lives in Arizona these days, but he grew up in Ketchikan. He says it was a no-brainer to want to shoot his first film here.
One of the reasons I made this film is I think Ketchikan is one of the most beautiful places on Earth, and I think the film is a testament to the artistic community in Ketchikan.
The Ladder is a film about aging. It centers on this older guy, Arthur, a commercial fisherman who's getting too old to fish. Early on, we learn his wife died and his son lives in New York City. Arthur wants his son to move back to Alaska, but they have a sort of strained relationship. And then this flashy biotechnology company sets up shop in Ketchikan. They're there to use this sort of isolated, aging Alaskan town to conduct clinical trials of a new procedure called the Fresh Start. Without giving too much away, basically you go into the procedure an old person and come out looking and feeling exactly like your 20-year-old self. But there's more than meets the eye.
People think of coming of age movies, they think like, you know, a boy becoming a man. And I was like, it'd be much more interesting to do like a man kind of accepting this old age and this final chapter of his life. Yeah, I kind of was like, I'm going to give this character exactly what he wants and try to find a reason why maybe that's not really what he needs to do.
Most of the film's stars and all of the film's extras were recruited from Ketchikan. The head doctor for the biotech company and a Fresh Start recipient herself is played by local artist and musician Tora Zamora. Arthur is played by local actor Keith Smith. And Torres says thanks to a lot of Ketchikan residents, a Kickstarter campaign he put together to complete production on the film raised over $50,000. The story is deeply Alaskan, but a lot of the themes are universal. Human beings outpaced by technology, the next big miracle drug, finding meaning in a world that is constantly changing.
But really, I think at its core, it's how do a father and son navigate their relationships changing as they get older, but also how they navigate what their life means in a world that is changing around them.
Torres first piloted the story as a short film, which has since racked up nearly 200,000 views on YouTube, taken home a Critics' Choice and Best Acting Performance Award at two short film festivals, and can be found on Alaska Airlines in-flight entertainment.
The blood tests are back, and everything checks out healthily. Congratulations, Arthur. You've been cleared.
Really?
Yes, Arthur. Really?
So what now?
And the latter joins a pretty short list of films that were actually filmed in Alaska. The Frozen Ground with Nicolas Cage and 50 Cent comes to mind. Or the 2012 thriller, Beyond. They were both filmed in Anchorage. But a lot of films are like The Proposal, that 2009 rom-com with Sandra Bullock and Ryan Reynolds that's supposed to be set in Sitka, but most of the filming happened in New England. Oh, and remember Insomnia? That movie where an LA cop, Al Pacino, tracks a serial killer, Robin Williams, through a fictional Alaskan town? That Alaskan town was filmed in Squamish, British Columbia. And that's what Torres says is so exciting about the Fargo Film Festival in Fargo, North Dakota, choosing to screen his film. People so far away getting a taste of Ketchikan.
And the goal will just be sort of to be the cheerleader for the latter and be the cheerleader for, you know, this movie that Ketchikan made.
The Fargo Film Festival happens every year in March, and silver screen icon Molly Ringwald will be in attendance this year for a special screening of her classic film, The Breakfast Club. Torres' dream is to be a full-time filmmaker. So he says the ideal situation is his film wins some awards. Maybe a Hollywood producer sees it at a festival like this one and likes it enough to put it in theaters across the country. For independent filmmakers, that's like winning the lottery. Torres says so many people in Ketchikan invested in the film or donated their time or personal belongings as props, and some have yet to see the film.
I just would say to those people, like, I appreciate you so much. Be patient, because the film will eventually be publicly available.
Torres screened the film for the very first time to Ketchikan audiences last fall at the local Coliseum Theater. The theater filled with cheers every time viewers recognized one of their friends on the big screen. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Ashlyn O'Hara in Kenai, Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks, and Jack Darrell in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight was Tobin Shelby. Tim Rocky's our producer. And I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education.
The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
for built to last.
That's what you get.
That's what you get.
That's what you get.
So that's what you get.
That's what you get. Changing your mind.
That's what you get for changing your mind.
That's what you get. That's what you
and
get.
After all this time,
I just hope you understand. Sometimes it goes do not make me all we have to hold is to take these lies and make them true. So all we have to see is that I don't belong to you and you don't belong to me. Yeah, yeah. Freedom. Oh, freedom. My freedom. You got to give what you take.
I had to come and get it straight from